Alex, we're cold opening the cold open. This is a Tipping Pitches first. Coming in before the music. Isn't that kind of horrifying to think about? I like to have the music as like a, you know, a buffer to make sure that people aren't hearing my voice within the first 0.005 seconds of the podcast. But this is a special occasion.
It is.
We're cold opening the cold open to remind you that this episode that you're about to hear was recorded partially on Saturday, August 27th, and partially on Wednesday, August 24th. Now, this episode was supposed to run on this past Monday, but of course, the minor leagues are being unionized, and so we decided to do a reaction podcast to that news instead and release this episode on Thursday, the day that you're hopefully listening to this. But we felt that it was important to remind you folks that, because we're not going to talk about the minor league unionization for the entire rest of this episode, because it had not happened yet when we recorded it.
Yeah. This is also why we're not going to do much discussion of Taylor Swift's Midnights on this podcast, which,
yeah,
frankly, we didn't get to it on Monday's podcast either. And no. I am kind of waiting for the moment that that we can break all this news down.
I mean, it's probably like next episode, right? Like, we don't have enough time to do this now because there was a whole hour and 30-minute episode that we're tacking this intro onto.
Yeah.
And I don't think that people really want a two-hour podcast, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe people want...
If the last half hour is Taylor, I think people are down.
Well, maybe people just want a Tipping Pitches music podcast instead. Like, separate feed, separate everything. We just do that. What do you think?
Sounds like you're tipping your pitches a little bit.
I mean, maybe. Maybe I am. Maybe I'm not. Check the poll if you're on Spotify. Yeah.
This is all parody unless it's not.
It's all parody until it's not. One quick coda to our episode on Monday is that over the last couple days... Well, number one, people have continued to just reach out to us and say that this news is the best news ever. And it's been cool to watch everybody kind of sit with how seismic this news is over the last couple of days. And I think you and I as well. But this story is by no means going away. And so we'll be covering it more and more and more over the coming months. And hopefully we'll be talking to, like I mentioned on last episode, hopefully we'll be talking to a lot of the relevant figures in this fight. Including, you know, players, people on the union side, like whoever we can get to talk about this, we're going to try to get to talk about this. I saw an article today in the Sports Business Journal, Alex, that had some new Tony Clark quotes in it that we hadn't really seen him talk about when we did our last episode on Monday, which was that he's been, quote unquote, overwhelmed by the amount of union cards that they received back in the first 24 hours. So, you know, we talked about how it would be surprising if they did not have the requisite interest from minor leaguers in order to definitely approve the authorization of the MLBPA, but even get that 50% vote to have a union, it would be surprising if they had involved themselves so publicly in this so early on, if they didn't have some kind of indication as to the support that they were going to receive from this subset of 5,000 minor leaguers. But it's encouraging to see him talking to media outlets about that sort of thing, because getting the ball rolling is a scary step in this process, but if that ball continues to roll and they continue to pick up momentum, it's going to be really cool to watch unfold.
Yeah, well, and like we've discussed so many times before, one of the biggest obstacles to organization in the minor leagues has been the atomization that you feel as a player, and feeling like at any given moment, if you say something that's slightly out of step with the company line, you will be on the chopping block. And so all of a sudden, players now have a lot of cover to actually say, what are you going to fire all of us? You need someone. So obviously last year we saw the Fair Ball campaign that was participated in by Mets and Phillies minor leaguers. And there were reports of potential retaliation that were never really confirmed, but that's the kind of thing that you face when you organize this sort of effort. So obviously at the time, the fact that a pair of teams were participating in this in itself was overwhelming. And I think that this just speaks to that level of kind of unspoken support that they have, right? Yeah. It's like you start talking to the guy to your left and talking to the guy to your right, and you're like, wait, are you down with this? Are you, because like I'm, but like, are you, you know?
A classic unionization experience.
Exactly.
I'm actually happy for the minor leaguers that they're getting to have that experience, because truly it's one of the fun, it's one of the most anxiety inducing, but then anxiety relieving experiences that I've ever had in my life, where like coworkers would be like, so like you tweet about things that I support.
Right. You kind of have to tiptoe into it. You'd be like, so that's crazy. They haven't reloaded the soap in the bathroom in a while, right? How do we feel about that? Do we think they should buy more soap for us? Or will that cut into their bottom line?
How weathered is your copy of the Communist Manifesto? Yes. So all of this to say, thank you to everyone who listened to our episode on Monday. If you didn't get a chance to listen to that and you are listening to this one currently, I would suggest maybe queuing that one up next, because it was obviously the culmination of a lot of the coverage that we've been doing with regards to the minor leagues, with regards to our merch over the last 2+ years. So if baseball and labor are of interest to you, this is probably one of the biggest stories that has ever happened. And I'd be surprised if those two things were not of interest to you, were you to be listening to this podcast. We have a great episode coming up. Some Saturday banter that is now 5 or 6 days old, but that's okay, because it's still fun, as well as friend of the podcast, Matt Ritchie, on his thesis about how we get more Black players playing baseball. So I hope everyone will stick around for that. Now let's get to the episode.
Tell us a little bit about what you saw and being able to relay that message to Cora when you watched Kimbrel pitch and kind of help out so he wasn't tipping his pitches.
So tipping pitches, we hear about it all the time.
People at home understand what tipping pitches is all about.
It's amazing.
And that's remarkable.
Alex, the news that set the world ablaze this past week was that Joseph R. Biden, president of the United States, in his capacity as president, will be forgiving $10,000 of student loans for people who are making under $125,000 per year. Now, we are a baseball podcast. We're famously
kind of
we're not a presidential politics podcast for all the things that we are. We're not that. We do talk about, you know, larger sociocultural issues from time to time, as listeners of this podcast may know. But I did, when I saw this news and I saw a lot of people talking about this loan forgiveness in comparison to the PPP loan forgiveness, Alex, one of my first thoughts was, who in the baseball world got a PPP loan?
Amazing. I knew where this was going almost as soon as you started talking.
So, you know, none of the 30 Major League Baseball teams were eligible for a PPP loan, because I think that they're all over $1 billion in valuation, which I think disqualifies you from the PPP loan program. I went through, I searched all of the owners' names, as you do. Mm-hmm. I didn't find anything too revelatory, because I think that most of these owners, were they to acquire a PPP loan, it would have been through some shell company that has a name that I don't know. So I wouldn't have known where to search in the ProPublica database for the PPP loan. Shout out to ProPublica. So then I just searched the term baseball, and I just scrolled through for a little while. And I found
investigative journalism right there.
Yes, exactly. And I found three things that might be interesting to you and our listeners.
Okay.
Okay, the first one is USA Baseball. You know, the organization that puts together Team USA, the organization right. that sends a baseball team to the Olympics, to the World Baseball Classic. An organization with close ties to Major League Baseball, though not really financially funded by Major League Baseball in a direct way.
Right, not affiliated per se, but lots of crossing of streams.
Exactly. They received $614,870, all okay. of which was forgiven.
Oh.
Now, okay, the PPP loan program was meant to keep companies affected by COVID running smoothly, cover their payrolls, that sort of thing. You can see how in some world the government would want to say, hey, this is USA Baseball, we need to keep their heads above water. They received this loan on February 9th, 2021. So that's where we're starting. Loan number two, Alex.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this one's my favorite one.
Okay.
I saved the third one because I think it has more of a dramatic payoff for the podcast purposes. Mm-hmm. But I'll just tell everybody and you, my friend, that this is my favorite one. 1,333,600 for the National Baseball Hall of Fame Museum Incorporated.
Ooh.
Now this one's directly related to Major League Baseball.
It is, yeah.
So
was it all forgiven?
All of it, yeah. Actually, an extra $8,000 was forgiven because of interest.
Good.
They received this loan on April 9th, 2020. So they saw the pandemic. They were like, time to get this loan right away.
Mm-hmm.
Now, even if Major League Baseball doesn't directly fund the Hall of Fame, they definitely could give them a $1.3 million grant to keep their heads above water
right
during the pandemic.
Does it give you the breakdown of where that money went?
It says all of it went towards payroll.
Mm-hmm.
It gives you a breakdown. So here are the categories that the money could go to. Payroll, utilities, mortgage interest, healthcare, rent, refinancing, and debt interest. This all went towards payroll, according to ProPublica.
As in theory, it should, right? Now, payroll is a very broad term. But that is what these loans are technically for, right? It's a paycheck protection program. And it's meant to subsidize, quote unquote, small businesses.
Yeah.
Or less than small.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Like, so they had 5 weeks into the pandemic, the National Baseball Hall of Fame Museum ran out of money. One of the most well-funded museums in the entire United States. Given grants by a $15 billion industry in Major League Baseball.
Well, they had to wage their propaganda campaign to make sure that the steroid users remained out of the hall, obviously.
Okay. Are you ready for the third PPP loan that I discovered?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will say there's 98 wonderful PPP loans that went to like small developmental baseball companies, all for like $28,000 or whatever. This third one that I found, Alex, $161,498 for a little old thing called the Cincinnati Baseball Museum.
Hmm.
Now, you might say Cincinnati Baseball Museum, is this just like an independent mom and pop baseball museum for the folks of Cincinnati that they can go to either for free or a very low price? Well, I wonder the same thing. And so I searched Cincinnati Baseball Museum. And the only thing that I could find, Alex, was the Cincinnati Reds Hall of Fame, which is in the inside of Great American Ballpark.
Slick. Not really slick enough.
Yeah.
I mean, our man Bob is hurting these days. We know this, right? We've covered this extensively on this podcast that the carrot industry is tanking right now.
Exactly.
He's got carrots and lettuce and mushrooms, porcini. The Vegetable King, Bob Castellini.
Now, but you would think that if Bob was really hurting for money, he would try to get something through his wholesale carrot empire.
Right.
Not funnel.
Well, do we know that he didn't?
Now, not through the PPP loan program. So maybe he took advantage of some other program that affected food wholesale or affected companies of a certain size or affected people who were directly harmed by issues in the supply chain or something like that. He, you know, Bob probably knows about those things.
Right.
Not Phil. Phil was busy doing other things.
Like Coke.
Allegedly. This is parody. But an enterprising businessman, especially one in Major League Baseball, would never let a program like this, which could be taken advantage of, not get taken advantage of. So he just had to get an extra $162,000 for the Cincinnati Baseball Hall of Fame. Or the Cincinnati Baseball Museum, rather.
I mean, that's a cornerstone of baseball right there. It's keeping the game's history alive.
That certainly seems to me like a violation of what the PPP loan was designed for.
Yeah, but the PPP loans were designed to be violated.
I know.
Right? Like,
filling out a half-page application to get $162,000 for one of the billionaire owners of Major League Baseball.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Can I just say, mm-hmm. So I did not have the initiative that you had to search this database for Major League Baseball owners.
I really just searched the word baseball and scrolled.
Or just searched the word baseball.
While I was editing another podcast. I also, wait, before you say what you're going to say, I also did fire a cheeky little email over to the folks at ProPublica asking if they could help me look even further into this category of sports teams and specifically baseball owners.
Any word back yet?
As the journalist that I am, I did that. I did that legwork.
Okay.
No. Haven't heard back from them yet, though I did email them on a Friday morning. So, you know, I'm giving them the weekend.
Yeah.
Giving them the weekend.
I looked up one name.
Okay.
One company.
John Fisher?
No.
What, we don't want to look into him because he's your friend.
No, try again. Who did I look up?
I don't know.
A-Rod Corporation received $223,300. And guess what?
I would love to know.
None of it forgiven. They paid that shit back like the good citizens they are.
Wow. Wow. So when A-Rod goes on a podcast and he says, I don't think student loans should be forgiven, just know that he's coming from a place of honesty.
Right. Exactly. At least he's not talking out of both sides of his mouth.
At least he's not a hypocrite.
His politics are consistent.
This reminds me that you could have been part of that PPP loan. You could have got your paycheck from that PPP loan had you not been a fucking coward and applied to be A-Rod's assistant at A-Rod Corp.
I do peruse their job postings from time to time just to
It's a real company.
I mean,
they have real employees.
Supposedly.
They do real work.
I'm not sure what it is. I looked into his SPAC a few weeks ago just to like see what it was up to.
Is it SPAC or is it SPAC?
SPAC.
You're losing the finance bros. When they can sniff fakes.
I know, they really can.
And we're not fakes, we're real.
Right.
You were almost A-Rod's assistant.
Famously, finance bros have never been duped before. All that to
say, I'm still waiting for the time when finance bros weren't duped.
Yeah, I know. You want to talk Bitcoin?
Anyway, his SPAC.
Nothing.
It just didn't say what he does?
It's just not up to anything right now.
Oh. So you're saying that the company that would eventually bring him public is not up to anything.
Correct.
That's what SPACs are for, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
He's the finance bro that I am.
I just like...
Why does he need to be publicly traded? What good or service is he offering?
I don't know. His expertise, man.
I guess, but like, is A-Rod Corp a consulting company? Or is it just like is that his holding LLC for his... like landlord enterprises?
I think media
production company? As far as I know, the only like real product that A-Rod Corp puts into the world is the A-Rod YouTube channel.
Right.
That's the only thing that I can point to and say that's what they do.
Yeah. I mean, I think they do real estate. It's like real estate and finance, you know?
But like, they also do like business leadership courses, right?
Yeah, whatever that means.
Dude, can you sign up for one?
Are they open to the public?
I don't know, but like, I feel like within 6 months, you could put together like enough of a resume or like enough of a story, at least, that you could get into one.
Uh-huh.
And so I want to challenge you here live on the podcast to do that.
Okay.
And whatever money that you need for it, I'm willing to sign off on spend that expenditure from the Tipping Pitches Patreon fund.
Okay.
And frankly, I think that anyone listening to this who is one of our patrons is probably willing to do that too.
Right.
Like if we put it to a vote, that would be a yes, most likely.
I actually might think this is the best idea we've ever had.
We could make a narrative podcast out of it.
But only if Alex Rodriguez is actually leading it. Like, I don't want his boy, Nick Silva or whoever
it is.
I don't know.
See, this is why we need a narrative podcast.
He just posts pictures of Nick, like, asleep at work. I'm too deep in the A-Rod Instagram rabbit hole. It's a lot of workout videos these days.
Yeah.
It's a lot of, like, circling the calories burned.
Calories burned in a workout is a myth. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Not to turn this into a workout podcast, fitness podcast,
right.
Nutrition podcast.
It's finance and nutrition. Those are our lanes.
Sounds like we're stepping on A-Rod's lane. If we don't stop now, he's never going to let you into his business mentorship program.
I know.
I just really want you to become A-Rod's protege. You already got the name.
True.
You've already got mini Alex.
I mean, when I was a kid,
I have no idea where this is going.
No, it's nothing special. But when I was a kid,
I wanted to be a CEO.
My name is Alex Baisley, and my baseball nickname. They were like, "Oh, we'll do a little A-Rod thing and call you A-Bay."
Yeah, I know that.
Right.
Yeah,
So like,
I used to go a bay bay to you all the time.
Right. Yeah. You and every 13-year-old that I palled around with.
Except I was 19 when I met you.
Yes. I don't know if that's better or worse.
It's better.
All I'm saying is
you're still around. So clearly good.
All I'm saying is we do have that like kind of emotional connection.
I right? have no doubt, no doubt that if Alex Rodriguez was sitting 3 feet to my left right now with a microphone in front of him, that we would have fun.
I mean, absolutely.
If we were having dinner, we would have a good time. So I think that you could do this.
Is this like one of those Twitter prompts where they're asking like, would you rather have $1 million or a dinner with Alex Rodriguez?
Yeah, and we're like a titan of industry.
We're like a dinner because you can't put a price on the knowledge he's going to give us.
I think it actually, for our purposes, in this weird little niche that we've carved out, in the long run, I do think that we could turn a dinner with Alex Rodriguez into more than $1 million. As long as it was allowed to be recorded.
Right. Yeah.
Because all podcasters make millions of dollars, including us. We're raking in millions.
So that is true. Mostly, but mostly through the PPP loan program.
Mostly through the SPAC that we started. okay. Well, this was fruitful. We've now put you on a mission to meet Alex Rodriguez at one of his maybe existent business leadership courses.
Right. I'm going to look into it.
Okay.
We'll circle back.
Okay.
I think we have an actual podcast to do, but no, I won't forget it either.
All right. We're going to do that actual podcast. Someone that you won't be meeting and talking to and taking his business leadership courses is Artie Moreno, because he's getting the fuck out of baseball. And I imagine he will probably not do anything public after that. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about Julio Rodriguez's weird extension. Then we're going to have a great conversation with friend of the show, Matt Ritchie, who just completed his thesis in the PhD program at Northwestern. And Matt's thesis topic was, why aren't there more black players playing baseball right now? And how can we get more black players playing baseball? So we talked about that for about 45 minutes, which is a really great conversation. So I hope everybody will stick around for that. Before we do all of that, I am Bobby Wagner.
I'm Abe Bay.
And you are listening to Tipping Pitches. All right, Alex, before we get into it, I'd like to thank the United States government for the massive PPP loan that we received. I'd also like to thank our new patrons this week. Shout out to Naveen and Carlos. Which do you want to talk about first? You want to talk about Artie Moreno or you want to talk about Julio Rodriguez? The two guys keeping baseball in the pop culture.
Let's talk Artie.
Okay.
He feels like this one's right in our wheelhouse, right? I mean, Julio is too, but this is a day that we've been anxiously waiting for with bated breath. And I'm curious to see kind of how you feel about it.
So for those who don't know, it was reported last week that Artie Moreno is exploring a sale of the Los Angeles Angels. So we know about as much about this. Actually, at this point, we know less about this. We know about as much about this as we knew at the time that we talked about the Learners exploring the sale of the Washington Nationals before the baseball season started. So right after the CBA was signed, the Learners were like, time to let everybody know we want to get the fuck out of here. And Artie Moreno, you know, has been in the news this year because of an FBI investigation into him and the mayor of Anaheim as it pertains to the sale of the parking lot, the area around Angel Stadium, and how it would be developed. But this is slightly different. I don't want to say that I'm surprised that Moreno might be interested in selling the Angels, but my takeaway whenever like a terrible owner like Moreno is interested in selling, I'm always like, why now? You know, why not 5 years ago when everybody hated you then? Like, you needed to stick it out for these last 5 years because of what? I wish that we could just like get a no holds barred explanation from any of these guys about when they decide to sell the team. And why? Well, of course, never get that.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, my number one takeaway is that I'm happy for Angels fans.
Yeah.
Although not like celebrating it yet because we don't know who's coming in next.
Yeah. The question of why now is a really good one. It does feel like the organization in general is at a bit of a crossroads, mm-hmm. right? You have another year of finding middling success. Right. And not being able to do much with the two greatest players on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
You have Shohei Ohtani's contract, which is expiring after the 2023 season.
Yeah.
And obviously, you have the corruption probe that doomed Moreno's bid to buy the land that Angel Stadium sits on and the area around it from the city of Anaheim, right?
Yeah.
I just wonder if Moreno thinks it's like worth it anymore. You know, he doesn't have anything to show for his two decades in ownership, right? He came in right after the Angels won the 2002 World Series. So, which incredible that you inherited a World Series winner wow. and couldn't do a single thing with
couldn't it. Couldn't have happened to a better guy. Maybe he's just really invested in the future of the Republican Party.
I mean, how long until he appears on Fox News?
Is he not like already appearing on there regularly? I have no idea.
I mean, he's a shadow producer. But like, I wonder if he isn't just kind of like reading the writing on the wall about the direction of the franchise and his yeah. ability to actually make something happen with it, right? Because he's not able to purchase this land that might enable him to build a new stadium. The Angel Stadium is one of the oldest in baseball right now.
And it's not very good.
And it's not very good.
It's just my analysis.
And
have you been there?
No.
You been to Dodger Stadium?
Yeah.
Have we been to Dodger Stadium together?
No.
All right, I'm just checking all the boxes. Just making sure that I'm not forgetting important events that we've done together.
I feel like he just may not want to be caught holding the bag. When Ohtani walks,
yes,
that the future of the franchise is kind of in dire straits at that point, right?
Yeah.
Because then all of a sudden you're back to where you were 10 years ago with Mike Trout and nothing else,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so something tells me that he may not trust himself to actually be able to put together a winner, you know? And it's certainly not because the Angels Stadium, it's certainly not because the Angels aren't raking in money like every other baseball team. Right?
Oh, yeah.
They still are. So I think it's not about that. It might just be sheer boredom.
Sure.
You know, after playing the game for two decades, you say, shit, really?
This is way harder than I thought it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that the book is closed yet on dealing with the Ohtani situation. Like, I don't
right.
know for sure that he will sell the team before he has to make that decision. Because the learners, you saw how accelerated that process can get, where I guess the learners deemed it better to start from scratch for whoever the next ownership group is. Now, we haven't seen who that next ownership group is going to be, but you would think that they would have had to have some indication that it would be okay to strip the franchise for parts before selling it to whoever
Maybe.
Is going to buy it.
I mean, I don't know that you can actually solicit that guidance, can you?
I have no fucking idea.
That feels,
are there laws around this? I don't
that
know.
It feels illegal.
Why? what
to have
law
a
is it violating?
Potential investor advising on business decisions before being a part of the company?
Who are you? It's not like the SEC has jurisdiction over this, though. They're not like publicly traded.
I mean, I don't fucking know. Like
exactly. That's what I'm saying. Once again, I mean, exposed for not being finance bros.
Right, exactly. I mean, that's the thing with like baseball owners is like looking at things they do and being like,
is that
feels,
legal?
That feels like it's probably against the rules.
So
right?
like, okay, even if it's not illegal, I don't think that the learners would have traded Soto had they not at least assumed that the next ownership group would not lower the price of their offer because of that, or would not be completely back out of a deal because of that.
Right.
Otherwise, they wouldn't have done it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and you would have had to have had at least preliminary conversations where those people buying the team could be like, hey, if I had Ted Williams on my team, I wouldn't want to trade him. You know, like
yeah.
they could like wink and nod their way to indicating that the next ownership group would want to have Juan Soto. I almost said
right.
Ted Williams. But I don't know. For Ohtani, I feel like Moreno will still have to make the decision.
Probably.
And
yeah.
I think most likely the decision will be that he's not going to be on the Angels anymore.
Correct. I don't think he's going to pull together a actual sale of the team in the next 6 months or whatever.
Although,
right?
I mean, it does happen fast when it happens.
It does, yeah.
Like the Wilpon rumors, it was like less than a year till they sold the team.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Speaking of rumors, I'd like to start a rumor right here on this podcast.
Okay.
And I'd like everybody who's listening who has a vested interest in the New York Mets to pass this rumor on. Don't say where you heard it first. Just pass it on. Just say I've been hearing from the baseball media. I would like the rumor to be oh, well, the Angels are going to be selling. You never know what's going to happen with that, with their personnel. And Brandon Nimmo next year, the Mets are probably not going to re-sign him. They need a center fielder. I know a guy who plays center field who's on a very expensive contract that most teams in baseball wouldn't want to trade for, but Steve Cohen doesn't give a fuck. So you just absorb the entirety of that contract, give him back a prospect or two, whatever. Here, take a couple of prospects. Mike Trout, welcome to Queens.
Would you take Trout over Ohtani?
I mean, if I had the choice, no. But I think that more teams will be hot after Ohtani in terms of, like, you'll have to pay a prospect price that the Mets would have a hard time competing with, similar to the Juan Soto situation. But trading Mike Trout at this point with his injury concerns, whatever, just going to hand wave that because it freaks me out that the best player of our lifetime just might have his career cut short.
Yeah.
I think that you'd have fewer teams trying to trade for Trout because he makes whatever, $40 million, $35
million right,
for the next 9 years.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose the best possible outcome is Ohtani isn't traded and he hits free agency.
And you trade for Trout and sign Ohtani.
There you go.
Start that if you want. I don't give a fuck. Yeah. I'm just starting the Mike Trout to Queens rumor because there's literally no center fielders who are going to be free agents this upcoming year. Like, the best option would be signing Judge and putting him in center field, which, I mean, that's not a bad option, but there's no other good center fielders.
Right. He's also not actually a center fielder.
Yeah, he does fine there.
Yeah.
I think at this point it'd be a downgrade from Brandon Nimmo at center. Now we're just talking Statcast defense data.
Yeah, we are. Hey, I mean, Mike Trout, New Jersey boy.
Exactly. Although New Jersey in a different way.
Yes, in a very different way.
I'm just saying, like, the Mike Trout to the Phillies rumors have been red hot for like 8 years. Mm-hmm. I just want to reclaim that. I just want to claim that away from them. Steal that.
That's
Mike
good.
Trout to the Mets. You heard it here first, but when you tell people that you heard it, don't tell them that it was here first because they will immediately disregard it because we don't have any sources.
Just know it in your heart that you heard it here first.
Exactly. Tell everybody you know. That might make its way up to Billy Epler. It seems like Billy Epler kind of just makes the most obvious choice in terms of how to spend Steve Cohen's money. That's his philosophy as a GM. It's just like, what is the most obvious way to spend the most money?
Which is how more GMs should operate.
No, exactly.
I want to be clear.
Yeah, Billy Epler. Thank you, based Billy Epler. Mike Trout. Okay, back to Artie Moreno.
I mean, I don't know that I have much more to say. You know,
No.
We know very little about this, right? Beyond the statement that he put out saying he's going to explore options, going to put together a team that's going to put together a potential package for a sale, right? And that's really kind of it.
Yeah.
Besides him saying, oh, I've loved doing this for 20 years, cashing checks. Well, the Angels have been 500.
Terrible. Like, just one of the worst owners in pro sports.
Kind of remarkably bad.
Yeah. Like, you'd think with the amount of big contracts that he's been willing to give, you'd think they would have, like, lucked themselves into a 95-win season one of these times.
Yeah.
They just never did.
Like, here's the thing is, I think being a GM is probably a lot harder than people give it credit for, right? A lot of fans are like, oh, I could run this team. You know, like,
yeah.
I think fantasy sports has done a lot to give fans the notion that they know how to run a professional sports franchise. It's a hard job. Being an owner is a far easier job than I think people would like to admit.
Just say yes.
You'd literally just sign the checks. And I understand, like, an aspect of that is also, like, hiring the right people and facilitating and cultivating the right sort of culture for success.
Sure.
But I also don't think that's
what you hire A-Rod for.
That is why you hire A-Rod.
That's why he needs
his business leadership classes.
No, exactly right. So once you've completed the business leadership class, you could buy the Angels, basically, and run them better than Artie Moreno.
Well, so this is a perfect time to introduce our fourth tier of the Patreon, which is the Buy the Angels tier.
Yep.
It is $1 million a month.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we could pretty quickly get to a number that Artie Moreno would be happy with.
I got a question.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this is an uncouth question to ask, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you think that a single person listening to this podcast makes more than $1 million a year?
Jesus.
Statistically unlikely.
Statistically unlikely.
But I believe in our listeners.
I mean, How many millionaires are like listening to podcasts in general?
I don't know. Inflation. Don't have millionaire is just your 100,000-aire now. Don't answer the question. It's okay. Should we talk about Julio? Yeah. You got more to say about Artie?
No, I have nothing more to say about him.
It's only up from here, Angels fans. I promise. Julio Rodriguez is basically a Seattle Mariner for the rest of his career, most likely.
Yeah. Into like his 40s, potentially.
Signed a really weird contract. Effectively Wild did this, and so I'm just going to do the same thing. They just read Jeff Passan's tweet thread because it's too confusing to do it in any other way. Mm-hmm. Here's Jeff Passan. Thread. There's a lot to digest on Julio Rodriguez's extension with Seattle, per ESPN sources. The ESPN sources were like, Jeff, there's a lot to digest. The deal could be for 8, 13, 16, or 18 years, sure. It guarantees Rodriguez $210 million. If it maxes out, it will be the largest ever, $470 million. The details are important. Here they are. The base of the deal is for 8 years and $120 million. It includes this season and runs through 2029. After 2028, the Mariners must decide whether to pick up a club option. The size and length of that depends on Rodriguez's performance in MVP voting. The option is for 8 or 10 years on top of the original deal, depending on how Rodriguez fares in MVP voting, wins and finishes. It can range anywhere from $200 to $350 million on top of the original $120 million deal. If the Mariners pick up the option, Rodriguez's guarantee in the deal is at least $320 million. Now, if the Mariners don't pick up the option after year 7, stop me when it's starting to feel like a clown car. Rodriguez has a player option after year 8 for 5 years at $90 million, thus the 13-year structure and $210 million floor. He could turn it down and hit free agency right before his 30th birthday, too. So, okay. Now, we're not here to break down the every detail of this contract. It's not why I wanted to talk about the Julio Rodriguez extension. Why I wanted to talk about the Julio Rodriguez extension, and I'll say this to get it out of the way up top. Obviously, Julio and his agent know all this stuff. Obviously, this is a great decision for Julio the individual because he just basically guaranteed himself generational wealth no matter how his career turns out. We can say all that. That can all be true. Obviously, this is a great thing for Mariners fans, and it's the right thing that we want done on its face. We want stars of their teams to only ever wear the jersey of that team because it's a good thing for baseball. If that's what the star wants to do. And it's clear that Julio, by signing this extension, is interested in doing that. I think this is weird. It doesn't add up to me. I think that this is a super weird extension. It's basically just doing all of the negotiations for his entire career in one deal. So it's like, we're doing an extension to buy out all of my arbitration. We're also doing my free agency before all of that happens. We're also doing the possible second round of free agency all in one deal, and not all of it is guaranteed. It's just like, it's like no other baseball contract I've ever seen. It's not really market setting because we don't know what he's going to get paid. So the next 20-year-old superstar who comes up and they want to sign him to extension, and that 20-year-old superstar says, well, Julio got $470 million. The team's going to be like, no, he didn't. The team's going to be like, Julio got 8 years, $120 million. That's what we're working from. So it's really weird for like the economics of baseball in the grander scale in the way that we usually talk about them, which is the CBA dictates that arbitration is how you make your money until you hit free agency and then you get a big contract. That is the system that we're like supposed to have in most cases for most good players. And more and more and more and more, we talked about this with the Braves last week, more and more guys are choosing not to go that route. And so we're basically just like losing the arbitration system in practice, even if not in writing. That's my takeaway from the Julio extension. It's fucking weird.
It is weird. It's unlike any other baseball contract I've seen. And generally speaking, I think it's fine.
Yeah.
For both sides, even, right? Julio himself is, like you said, guaranteeing a lot of money for himself, right? He's guaranteed 210 right off the bat, depending on whether or not the Mariners exercise a team option down the road and whether or not he wants to pick up the player option, right? So, like,
I kind of don't even necessarily agree that he's quote unquote guaranteed 210. He could only get 120 from it, and then he could go to free agency before he hits his age 30 season.
Right. Although I think then you would have to factor in whatever he makes in free agency, right?
Like, yeah.
Like, I suppose worst case scenario, he just takes the 120. Both parties decide to walk away, which seems unlikely.
Yeah.
And then he hits free agency and gets paid like a motherfucker.
Yes.
I think it's interesting because of how highly performance based it is, right? Yes.
I don't like that.
Like you said, like the arbitration system is kind of going out the window right now as teams find ways to kind of skirt around it and basically set up their own financial system that is dependent on how well players perform
by the standards of MVP voting,
right? Which is really flawed
and fickle,
yeah,
and determined by dumb things,
right?
Not that arbitration is not also determined by dumb things, but it's at least determined by dumb things that we can predict ahead of time,
right? Exactly. And it's, I do think that the notion of a player's pay being determined by effectively members of the media is a kind of a weird and not great one.
Super
and I think that's probably a choice that the voters themselves are not interested in having, right? You don't necessarily want to cast your ballot knowing that it very well could have an impact on this person making $10 or $100 million, whatever it is. It does seem to set a bad precedent for me. That said, like you said, the overall premise of the deal itself is that Julio is a Mariner forever if he wants to be and if the team wants him to be, which, like, generally speaking, is a good thing.
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't even know what my takeaway is from this.
I guess so. If we ignored it as an individual case and if we said every superstar was going to do this from now on, that would basically completely implode the entire economics of baseball.
Yeah.
Because, you know, 50 to 75% of players don't have the option to sign a deal like this. And those 50 to 75% of players either have to sign a team-friendly extension that buys out their arbitration, or they have to go to arbitration. And now Julio is never going to arbitration. He's not going to put a salary and have to win or lose and win that number or lose that number for the next player that comes along. And I'm not saying that that's Julio's obligation to do. It's not. It's not. It's no one player's obligation to do this. But it's not just Julio. This is like becoming more and more the norm for guys to sign these long-term extensions. And we have no fucking idea what the baseball economic landscape is going to look like in 13 years. Or 8 years. That's two or three. This contract is two or three CBAs away from now.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's insane. And I don't know for certain that this will not come out as a quote-unquote pro-player contract. But what I do know is that baseball deals used to be all fully guaranteed. It wasn't contingent on finishing in the top five of MVP voting. It was, this player is great. If you want his services, you have to guarantee him this much money over this much time.
Right. And you'd get little bonuses here and there.
Right. Like $1 million if you pitch 200 innings or something like that. But right. It wasn't like a difference of $250 million over the life of the contract.
Right.
Now, obviously, that's a little bit blown out of proportion because the length of the contract changes for Julio is dependent on whether he picks it up, Mariners pick it up, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm fine with blowing up the economic system of baseball. I just would like to know who's blowing it up and how. Because if guys are just signing individual contracts like this, I'm actually not really sure what direction that leads us in. And this is probably as good of a deal as a 20-year-old player could sign.
Yeah.
I fully believe that. This is a great contract. Like, if he turns out to be a super, super, super duper star for a really long time, yeah, maybe it's team friendly. But if he's just like a really, really great player for a really long time, I think we'll probably look back on this and say, yeah, fair.
Yeah.
But like, I have no idea how this contract or any of the contracts that the Braves players have signed is supposed to help or hurt the next player who has to decide what contract to sign.
Yeah, I don't either. I mean, I think that it's foolish to try and make predictions about that. I think it's somewhat meaningful that the way the contract is structured is that it gives the Mariners flexibility year over year to actually add around him, right? Rather than mm-hmm. guaranteeing him $40 million every year, which then you can make the case that he's a quarter of the Mariners' payroll. And so as a result, that's why they just have to sign a bunch of like one war pitchers or whatever. Like there's actually ways to...
Paul Sewald. What the fuck?
There's actually ways to like build on this, right? In ways that say maybe Artie Moreno wasn't capable of doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose I prefer this to the alternative of flipping a guy mid-arb, you know?
Yep.
Like, as a fan, there's nothing that gets you more excited about your team than something like this. Like, economics aside, which is a huge thing to say, right? Yeah. But if you're an average baseball fan who's rooting for the Mariners and wants to see them contend year in, year out, and you want to go to a fuck ton of games, like, this is the thing that's going to get you to buy that season ticket package, right? Yep.
Get you to buy that jersey instead of the jersey. Like, you know he's going to be there now. It's worth buying the jersey.
Like, I know the whole, like, butts in seats thing is overrated, but, like...
I don't think it is overrated.
Having Julio Rodriguez on your team puts fucking butts in seats, man.
I think that this is good because the choice is probably between, most likely between, either an extension like this or, like, the Tatis extension, even though his was much more straightforward. Or even like the Acuna extension or whatever, Matt Olson, Austin Riley. The choice is either this extension or more likely go through ARB, get disenfranchised from ARB. Mariners are not in a similar competitive window. They don't actually re-sign him at a market value. He goes somewhere else. That is probably the second most likely scenario behind the most likely one, which is they extend him and keep him around.
Yeah.
And so if the only way to keep him around and in a Mariners uniform for his career is to sign extensions like this, then that's fine, right? But like, I just reject that as the dichotomy.
Right.
Because the option of going through ARB and fighting him tooth and nail for every single ARB dollar and then disenfranchising the player by the time he's ready to hit free agency so that he's ready to explore the open market and then another team swoops in and offers him a better contract because you don't want the potential blowback of offering a player who's 28 a 10-year contract or something like that because GMs are weird about that shit. But I just think that they've decayed the system and now they're getting around it in their own manner.
Yeah.
And I don't feel good about that.
Yeah, I agree. We're moving into uncharted territory right now with contracts in baseball. And the most recent CBA, I think, did very little to...
like provide clarity?
Yeah, provide clarity or give any sort of guarantee that the economics of the game aren't going to be like fundamentally changed.
Like chart a path in a better direction.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And here's the thing is like guys like Julio are always going to get paid anyway, right? Mm-hmm. He might set the market for his ilk of players, but the superstars were never the ones who I think we were the most concerned about anyway. There's a trickle-down effect for sure.
Right. And that's its own problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, for better or for worse, that is the truth.
Yeah.
And most of the time, it's for worse. All right, I think that's enough talk about Julio for a contract that might extend for the next 18 years. I think we have plenty of time to talk about it. let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll bring Matt Ritchie in. Okay, Alex. We are now joined by Matt Ritchie, freelance music and sports writer, former grad student at Northwestern, career 438 OBP at Johns Hopkins University. Matt, what's up, man?
Nothing much. How are we doing, guys? How is life and all that?
We're doing good. Life is fine. Hanging in there. Matt, you wrote a thesis. Congratulations on the thesis. That seems like a worthwhile occasion for celebration.
I wrote a thesis and nothing could have prepared me more. No, nothing could have felt better than submitting like just 5,000 words of just nonsense, but just letting it fly. I was like, oh, this hits harder than I assume most drugs would feel. Ferrara, I assume, allegedly, of course.
Allegedly, yeah, of course. Yeah. Don't incriminate yourself.
This podcast is parody anyway.
Exactly. So. Nothing we say here can be held against or for us in any way, shape, or form.
Legally, no.
On our 200th episode, Matt, we were asked by, it was like an AMA-style episode, and people could ask about anything baseball or non-baseball related, and a couple people asked us what we did our thesis on, and we talked about it, and at length, and people were very interested in it, and neither of us did our thesis on baseball. Mine was basketball related, but Alex had basically nothing to do with sports. Your thesis does have something to do with baseball. The you know, alleged topic of this podcast, tipping pitches here. So we wanted to have you on to talk about it, Matt. You wrote your thesis about the lack of black baseball players and how we can fix that, right? And I'd love to hear why you approached this topic, why you decided to do a thesis about it, and you know, your methods of study, all of these things we want to get into. But I guess the headlines first. Why you wrote the thesis, and I guess what your biggest takeaways were.
So I don't know if you guys can tell, but I am black. And so, and I've been playing baseball since I was four. Mm-hmm. And you sort of, when you're, you know, a black man playing baseball in America, you sort of realize a bunch of things pretty quickly. Depending on where you grew up, a lot of the times you might be one of a handful of kids on black kids on a baseball field, or black kids in a league, or on your high school team. And so, you know, it's a topic that most black African-American baseball players in the country can, you know, empathize with, can relate to, you know, have felt most of their life. And so I wanted to go to the thesis, do the thesis, because it was sort of a continuation of a story I released about a month ago. For the Chicago Reader, about a high school baseball team in Chicago, the Morgan Park Mustangs, about how they're sort of a beacon for black urban high school baseball, and how they sort of fit in the legacy of black baseball in Chicago, and what their existence and what their success and, you know, their coaching staff and what they all mean to the sport of baseball. And so basically I wanted to get a continuation of that, but from the other side of, like, okay, why aren't there more places like this in the rest of the country, or why aren't there more enclaves of, you know, just black baseball like we have in Chicago and the Jackie Robinson South League, where you just have a bunch of black kids playing baseball. And mm-hmm. that's sort of where I started from, the big main thesis idea, like way back in like May or something.
If you can even remember that time.
May is a blur.
So can you talk about what you found? Because we were speaking before we went live here, right? That we sometimes kind of
live,
live, quote unquote. you know, we occasionally take a bit of a flippant attitude towards some of the issues in baseball, where we're just kind of like, fuck it, burn it down, you know, because like that's the easy way to respond, especially when you're frustrated by a sport that you love and may not love you back, right? But you took the time to really take a deep kind of academic dive into some of these issues. And like you were saying, try and parse out why there aren't these sorts of enclaves. So what did you find? Were you focused more on why there aren't these spaces, or how to create these spaces?
So it was pretty interesting, because I believe it feels like this is one of the more researched topics in baseball at this current moment, especially since 2020. People are trying to figure out why black kids aren't playing baseball, why the, you know, it's the stat that black player participation at the major league level has been dropping since 1991. It's people have been trying to figure it out. And a lot of people think they have the causes, they think they have the reasons, which, you know, they're if you guess the reasons to why black people aren't playing baseball at a wide rate, you're probably going to be right. So a lot of people think that basketball and football have gotten more popular. They think that the culture of baseball isn't necessarily in tune with, you know, the black experience in the country. There is the cost, there is the amount of exposure. And so people have sort of agreed upon that. And I didn't want to write 5,000 words on things that people already knew. And so what it sort of shifted into was about what's being done to fix it, and not only what's being done, because, you know, we see what's trying to be done, but why aren't some of the things working, and what is the next step that needs to be taken in order to make sure that those tactics stick? So it was more, it was less so about the causes, which I think a lot of people have guessed, but more so the methods to fix the issue that we all see.
Yeah. I mean, so this podcast focuses mainly on things that affect or are touched by Major League Baseball and Minor League Baseball. I'm curious, like, you know, there's always this debate in large structural problems, how much of it can be fixed from a top-down approach versus how much of it needs to be fixed at a grassroots level, and which way is the superior way, which way will help more people, which way is the more moral way, which way actually will make an impact to the people who need it the most. Mm-hmm. And I think that people levy a lot of criticism against Major League Baseball and even their programs, which I think in many cases have been successful where they've tried to make the most effort. But I think people levy criticism against Major League Baseball for not taking some of these issues and many issues facing the game of baseball, but this one specifically for the purposes of your thesis, taking these issues as seriously as they need to be taken for a league that has made itself the dominant force in baseball worldwide, this one baseball concept that has kind of risen to the surface since Rob Manfred became commissioner. So I'm curious, like, how did you approach that question of, like, do we need more Major League Baseball influence? Do we need less Major League Baseball influence? If we're going to have more, what is it going to look like? And how did sort of the academic approach to this question manifest in trying to answer it?
So it's a really interesting thing because you're asking the organization that sort of caused this problem or let this problem happen under its watch to be like, all right, time to reverse the course of just decades of inactivity or, you know, apathy towards the issue. And so if you're asking someone to fix the problem they caused, they can only do it so well. And so MLB, they've kicked their diversity programming into overdrive in the recent years, which is great to see. You know, last year they dedicated like $150 million to these diversity programming efforts in order to get more Black people in the game, to get more diversity within their staffs. And you're like, okay, that's great. But on the widespread, you know, there's still a lot of variability with these programs because, you know, you have the RBI programs throughout the country, throughout and all the different cities. And what you definitely find is that not all RBI programs are made the same. They're not all created equally. They're not all treated with specific care. They don't go as far deep into, you know, the community driven aspects. So when you talk to people within the game and people who are either working within MLB or working within these grassroots organizations that have had interactions with the RBI programs, some of the RBI programs just aren't doing what they need to be done. And so if you want MLB to fix the issue, then there needs to be like a widespread overhaul of the amount of care being given to each of these programs. But you're asking MLB to care a lot more about that than that maybe they like, they should, but that they're going to do is another question. And so, and like, there are great RBI programs. I talked to the executive director of RBI, not the Cubs Charities, Alicia Gonzalez, a couple weeks ago for this project. And they do a fantastic job because they do a more holistic system that deals with a lot of community-driven aspects, a lot of making sure that it's not just a one-and-done thing, that they're trying to make sure that families and people who want to play either softball or baseball are supported all the way through. And so you get things like that, or, you know, you get other teams where RBI programs are more so just a photo op, a tweet. Once every couple of months, they go to the RBI World Series, and then boom, they're good for the year. And so it's very interesting that there's just so much variability about the RBI program that, you know, MLB can address, or but it's team specific. And so at what point is the oversight then their fault is sort of where I figured it out that.
I'm curious how much you think it is Major League Baseball's kind of responsibility to kind of address these issues. I mean, you were saying that to a certain point they could really only go so far, right? They can throw a lot of money at the problem and they can set up these sorts of organizations, but at the end of the day, it kind of comes down to how dedicated the people are who are actually working within them, right? And how engaged the community around them actually is with it. So are there pathways kind of outside of like capital M Major League Baseball that you think can be, I guess, effective in kind of acting as a sort of supplement to the sorts of organizations and programs that Major League Baseball is already kind of doing right now?
Definitely. And I think that definitely stems from the grassroots orgs that work to sort of fill in the gaps of what Major League Baseball can or would like to address. And so Major League Baseball does a fantastic job, I will say, in through their Dream Series, through their Breakthrough Series, through the Hank Aaron Invitational. They do a fantastic job recently of making sure that the best African-American minority high school baseball players are seen. They make sure that they get the exposure. They make sure, and you know, these events are cost-free, which is half the battle for, you know, getting to the next level of baseball. Mm-hmm. That's something that you find in that I wrote about in the thesis. Like the two big things really are cost and exposure. It takes a lot of costs, takes a lot of money to be seen, you know, at these perfect game events, at showcases, to get in front of scouts. It takes a lot of money. And if you don't pay that money, that means you're not getting seen by these coaches. You're not getting seen by these scouts. And so if you're not getting seen by these scouts, you're not making it to the next level. And so MLB can make sure that the cost is gone for these best players, but that ignores a large swath of the kids. And so what these grassroots organizations can do, they sort of supplement that by being like, all right, well, we're going to make sure that our kids are taken care of, that we're going to get 10 to 20 kids each year. And, you know, say you have, so I talked to Nelson Cooper, who is the executive director of Pittsburgh Hardball Academy. They started in 2020 and they're basically their own travel organization that serves underserved and Black communities in Pittsburgh and makes sure that they've got 14U, 16U, and 18U teams. And they make sure these kids get to the next level. And if you have a bunch of organizations like that, just sprinkled around the country, that's already filling in the gaps that Major League Baseball can't reach, that they haven't reached yet. And so it's about making sure that these kids get seen, and those grassroots orgs across the country are doing that. They're making sure that these kids have the fundamental skills, that they're getting to these showcase tournaments, that is how you sort of fill in the gaps of what MLB can't do.
So you brought up Perfect Game, which you could do your own whole thesis on Perfect Game itself. And Alex and I have talked about it, you know, a decent amount on this show, and we've talked about accessibility in baseball and that idea, that concept of exposure that you're talking about. And I think we've mostly framed it in the idea that Perfect Game is there to basically just like rent seek at each level of baseball, like to look for a way to just wring more money out of families and kids who are trying to cash in on a dream, trying to make it to Major League Baseball. They are there, and they've effectively like made a company that is able to turn that profitable. Now, I don't think that if Major League Baseball wanted to get rid of Perfect Game tomorrow, they could do it. But I do think that the pipelines to MLB are, like, Perfect Game being part of the pipeline to MLB has been completely normalized by Major League Baseball and the draft process. And I wonder, like, how much did you try to approach that in answering this question, as it being like a legitimate hurdle to come to overcome for a lot of these players? And how much of the blame should we be laying on the feet of places like Perfect Game? And even if you want to go further back, like certain little leagues, like being inaccessible right to most players, or even like little leagues folding in cities because of the lack of funding and then the subsequent lack of participation because of that lack of funding, because people can't just afford to take the money out of their own pockets.
well, you know, as everybody in the sport of baseball should know by now, that perfect game will ring you for all the money that you have if you want to get to the next level.
And Joe Biden, cancel perfect game debt.
Oh stat. Gosh, if he had canceled perfect game debt 30 years ago, we might. I know that's not when perfect game started, but you know what I mean. But it's just that organization is just so entrenched because, you know, when you see that these high school kids are getting drafted, they're getting the perfect game rankings. They're getting like, oh, these kids are the best because we've seen them at perfect game and we've decided this perfect game scouts have made this kid a top three draft prospect. And so you're like, well, do I have to be there in order to be a first rounder? Do I a second rounder, a third rounder? And families are spending like $3,500 to be on a team that even goes to perfect game like once or twice a year. And then that doesn't even count lodging, you know, people taking off of work. And so if you're pricing people out at the high school level already like that, just to be seen, you know, imagine how much money that it takes to even have the skills to be on one of those high case showcase teams. You have to go to trainings when you're in middle school. Now, when you're 11 or 12, you have to go get fielding practice, hitting practice. They're specializing pitchers at this age already. And so if you don't have that money, if you can't afford to send your kid to go be great at 11 years old already, then you're already out of the game. And that takes a huge swath of the percentage of people that could play the game, which then invariably includes African-American people. African-American people are not a monolith in this country. And I'm by no means saying that every African-American player that could play baseball is poor and unable to afford the sport of the game. But, you know, you're going to lose a large percentage of people that just can't afford to be seen by perfect games, to be seen by Baseball America, to get to those Under Armour All-American games. But MLB baseball is looking for those best players, you know? Mm-hmm. It's sort of the thing that feeds into itself. MLB, they want to be able to have these best players come in. They want to make sure that they're seen. And where they're getting seen? Perfect game. Well, if they get rid of perfect game, then scouts have to work harder. Teams have to spend more capital to find these kids. It's going to take a lot more money for them to do that. You know, there's a reason that there's a bunch of Dominican Republic academies for teams, and there's not a bunch of, you know, Baltimore-specific academies breeding black high school players in order to be seen. It's just more expensive to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. That it reminds me of that conversation, Alex, that we had with Ryan O'Hanlon when we talked about the difference between developing a soccer player in Europe and developing a baseball player in the United States. It's not honestly that different from how they develop kids at the Dominican summer leagues, in that it's just team specific and they pay for everything to do with their training. They pay for their housing. They pay for everything. And just like within the United States of America, that concept is so foreign because of the privatization of every single thing that we deem worthwhile in this country. And baseball being one of those things. It's just like the continued privatization of now the process of becoming a good baseball player, even though it's supposedly our national pastime and basically funded by public money.
You can even just look, compare the DR to here. You know, when a kid signs to one of those DR academies, they're there. Until they get signed again, until they enter like the 16-year-old international amateur draft, like you're like, oh, this kid is going to be probably in our organization. But say they're paying to develop a bunch of kids in high school somewhere in an urban center in the country, you know, the amateur draft, there's not a great chance that they end up on your team. Yeah. So imagine you develop
Bryce Harper and he ends up on the Mets.
Yeah. And you're just like, well, why would I do that if there's a chance that I'm not going to be able to control them with for the next 10 years. Right.
Yeah.
And so it's all about what you can get out of it to a certain point and like where's the opportunity cost that in order to pay for this?
Well, and you know, I think as we talk about this, I think how easy it would be for all the teams to get together and pool a little bit of their money and say, we're just going to subsidize Perfect Game for X number of years, right? Like we're going to effectively nationalize Perfect Game within the sphere of Major League
Wave
Baseball.
Wave the red flag, Perfect Game.
Far be it from me to ask baseball teams to spend more money on anything.
Oh, God,
right?
God.
I know. Like, I don't even want to go down that rabbit hole. But it does feel like there are some solutions here that are right in front of them. Not even necessarily solutions, but because ultimately they're band-aids. They're, fixing Perfect Game does not fix the dearth of black players in baseball, right? But if, like you're saying, if you can kind of chip away and start to bring down these barriers one by one, eventually you start to get some sort of wave, right? But there has to be actual commitment to that rather than just sort of throwing out a few programs in various areas and hoping that the kids come and find you. Because they may not even know that they exist, right?
Right. And the thing you mentioned about chipping away, black baseball in Major League Baseball peaked in 1981. Mm-hmm. You had 18.7% of the league was black players. I don't think we're ever going to reach that again. Even in my most optimistic stances, this season we started at 7.2% of the league. And now, according to, I think Clinton Yates wrote an article that's we're back to 8, at the All-Star break. We're never going to get to 18% again. You might get to 10 would be great. 10% of the league would be super cool. That would be great simply because it's about being able to see, to feel accepted in the game of baseball. And, if you look around a baseball field, you look around a Major League Baseball field and you only see 2 to 3 black players on a roster, black African-American players on a roster, you don't feel as welcome in the game. And then that just extends down because you're like, am I going to be able to even make it up there? What's it going to look like at the college level? What's it going to look like at the high school? The D3 landscape, I'll tell you, was just the widest level of baseball I've seen ever. These little small academic colleges up in the Mid-Atlantic, me and my buddy James, who was a year below me, we could count on two hands the amount of black kids in our conference that played baseball. And so, it's all about being comfortable in the game, which, MLB has tried to do that, tried to make in the past couple of years, tried to have a real concerted effort. But, that doesn't happen until the percentage raises and not so much just idols, but we love a star. We love a favorite player, but it takes chipping away and be like, oh, it's not just two black players on a roster. It's 4. It's not just one black pitcher. It's now 3. And so you're like, oh, it's starting to become a little more normalized. I'm starting to feel I start to relate to a couple more players on this in a game.
Well, it's interesting. You talk about kind of culture and acceptance within the game. We're recording this a couple days after on national television during the Little League World Series. There's a young black boy on a team full of white players who are putting cotton in his hair, right? Mm-hmm. And Little League World Series came out and gave kind of a mealy-mouthed statement about how no one was hurt by this, right? That all the families were all good and everything. But that felt like such a microcosm of kind of where the game stands today, where it can put forth all the initiatives that it wants, but unless the culture is within the game is changing simultaneously, you're not going to get very far with it, right? When you have guys at the major league level who are publicly spurning Black Lives Matter or whatever it is, I don't know. It feels like you're self-imposing limits, right?
And that's all about the comfort. You're going to look and you're like, well, if you go in a locker room and you see 39 guys that don't agree with, they don't relate to your experience. They don't, they like some of them don't agree with some of the things that you believe. it's going to be isolating. And, you know, baseball has all the old, we can talk about it, the culture, the unwritten rules, the yada yada, the don't bat flip, the don't wear the big chains, the if you bat flip, I'm going to hit you. And so, you know, when you get down to other sports, the two most popular sports for Black people in the country, basketball and football, they don't punish you for basically living the Black experience on the field. They don't punish you for having swagger, for having fun, for you know, being yourself. Mm-hmm. And so unless MLB baseball is ready to do away with everything that the sport has sort of been hinged on in the past 70 years, you know, it's hard to see like a realm where it's always going to be super accepting. You're going to have people in baseball that are working hard to try and fix the culture, but you know, not, there's a reason cultures like persist for hundreds of years, because that's just, it's entrenched. It's taught. It's learned that, like, you know, this is the way you play the game. This is the way you react to people who either look different than you or act different than you. And so, you know, it's hard to say that you can turn the tide of baseball by, you know, by playing a couple advertisements with rap songs over them, and then that'll fix all the issues. Like, it's just it just won't, like they can try and appeal, but you know, baseball still got that cultural touchstone that recently has just not recently but you know, feels unwelcoming to the average Black person.
So something that you said, that baseball doesn't care about the development of players until they get to the point where they can pay off for individual teams. Like, the, you know, the 30 major league clubs don't care about the development of players. Something that you said about that really sticks with me, because there's such a symbiotic relationship between playing baseball and becoming a fan of baseball. Like, if you played baseball when you were a kid, you are, I don't know how many times more likely to be a fan of baseball when you're an adult. And, you know, it confounds us often on this podcast and elsewhere how little baseball seems to care about developing lifelong fans of its product and what that actually means for the future of the sport. And I banned the topic of you know, fear-mongering about the future of the sport on the podcast, but I feel like it fits nicely into this conversation, Matt, because, you know, it strikes me that MLB doesn't really care about someone who plays D3 baseball. Like, they don't really care necessarily. Like, you're never on their radar. Like, if you only play baseball up to middle school, that's okay. If you only play baseball up to high school, that's okay. You can still love the game forever and it can still have given you something. But MLB doesn't seem to really be invested in that experience. And I wonder, like, it maybe in your research, but really honestly in just your opinion too, like, how do we get it over the hump to where MLB starts to care about developing interest in the game, regardless of whether those people actually end up in a major league uniform?
I mean, baseball is such a point. MLB has such like a point of entry thing. It's like, they really care about you if baseball was passed down from you, from your granddad or from your dad. Like, and the biggest example is the Field of Dreams game still being a thing. Like, the Field of Dreams game is the most boring concept in the entire world to me, because it appeals to a bunch of people who are living in the 1980s, who were old enough to care about the movie, and then had to then have progeny that they've passed down the interest in a Kevin Costner vehicle. Like, and it's just like, who is this for? Like, what type of stuff is this for? And so, like, you have to be educated in the baseball lore for baseball to care about you, to care about your interest, to fold you in, to make sure that they're going to cater to you and they want you to come to the ballpark, spend money, blah, blah, blah. And so unless you're like that, or, you know, you're going to be a future player or you're going to be in the professional leagues, then I guess you're shit out of luck, because like, it's like, I don't understand who they're marketing for half the time. And I don't understand why we send the same four teams over to London every year. I don't need to see.
You gotta think about the lads, man. Come on, what about the lads?
I love trying to grow the game. I love trying to make it a global thing, but like, it doesn't always need to be the, like, nobody cares about the Cubs. Like, and so as someone who lives in Chicago, people care about the Cubs, but like, nobody really outside of Chicago really cares about the Cubs.
Yeah.
And that's me being like relatively anti-Cub, but I love the ballpark though. It's a fun ballpark. But like, it's all about who you're trying to bring in the game and whether or not you care about that generation or that like slice of culture being a part of the game.
I remember when they first announced the Field of Dreams game, and they were talking about it on R2C2, or maybe it was after the first one that happened. And CC was like, yeah, this is cool. Like, it looked cool on TV or whatever. But why can't the next one be at Hinchcliffe Stadium in Patterson, where the New York Black Yankees used to play? And right. It's like, that had never even occurred to me as a possibility that MLB would want to do that or could do that. But that would be so easy to pull off for them to like renovate these old Negro League stadiums or like erect new stadiums in cities that used to have Negro Leagues teams. And it's just like, it feels like an easy slam dunk. Like, why does it take a decade for an idea like that to gestate is a major cultural problem in facing Major League Baseball right now.
And you have to remember, they only just recently started really caring about the Negro Leagues again.
Yep. At like, the Centennial. It took 100 years, my guy.
It took 100 years and a lot of work from the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum for Major League Baseball to be like, okay, you guys fine. Were there.
Yeah.
You guys, like, you can't write the story of baseball in America without the Negro Leagues. And it took them so long to even really say that. And so it's all about, like, who you want. If they don't think the majority of baseball fans will care about it, then they're not going to do it. Like, remember the Puerto Rican game where they had then the Cleveland baseball team, as I like to refer to them, because I like Guardians, but Cleveland baseball team is just much cooler to me. But I forgot who they played, but you know, they were in Puerto Rico and that game was electric.
Lindor homer was the loudest I've ever seen a stadium.
He could have wrenched president that day. And and I don't understand why baseball's like, all right, that's it. Let's go put people in a bunch of really old, relatively ugly uniforms, have them walk slowly out of corn and be like, all right, this is what the baseball fan needs, because it's what they think that their demographic is.
Yeah.
And it stems from the culture that they've cultivated and the fans that they've catered to for decades. And it all stems from, you know, it doesn't all stem, but it's, you know, it's a draining of Black participation from, because you don't have to cater to a community that only has 6% or 7% of players in the league. Like, that's just not a representative sample. You can cater to more Hispanic and Latin American teams or Latin American sensibilities, because there's more. There's just gonna be more fans. Like, they're like, all right, well, we can do this. There's a reason to do this. There, a lot of players would care about this. And so it's all about who is going to receive the most attention, which then gets back to who's being let into the game at the earliest and then stays in the game because
the longest.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, like, they're not wrong about their demographics, right? Like, I think the you have to hand it to Major League Baseball that, like, they know that the average baseball fan is like a white, probably man in his like 50s or 60s, right? And like, right, that's the one data point that's stuck in their heads, and they've just like pushed it into overdrive rather than saying, hey, maybe the country is a different one than it was 50 or 100 years ago or whatever, and maybe we're actually doing ourselves a disservice. Like, even from a business standpoint, right, you're doing yourself a disservice by not trying to make your sport at least a little bit more representative of what the country looks like today. Like, they're losing out as well. And I think they don't necessarily know that yet.
I think they're just so fat and happy that they don't care. Like, it strikes me as like very similar to how Hollywood 10 years ago decided that they needed to start making like big budget movies for Black audiences, so to speak, as if Black filmmakers were not making great movies this whole time. They just didn't have big studios behind them. Right. And now all of a sudden it's like, oh, we need to make sure that we're marketing towards everybody, or we're being more inclusive. And there's been a lot of backlash in how white Hollywood has been. And it's like, baseball seems perfectly content to winnow down their like demographic until it's basically non-existent. To me, that's what seems like it's happening. It has to get to like emergency level for them to ever actually change their approach to anything.
And it's really weird just because, like, even with like the drain of Black talent, and then they don't understand, it's not like they don't understand what's being lost, but they tout, you know, the history books, and mm-hmm. Black players fill the history books. But then you see the numbers are dwindling. There's not going to be that legacy of future Black stars to again fill those history books. And so you're like, then what is it? Like, every time I see Hank Aaron or Willie Mays trotted out on an MLB, like reel, then like, all right, so do you guys care that the legacy of Hank Aaron is dwindling as we speak? Every time you see Jackie Robinson's, any of his words just strewn out every April 15th, like, mm-hmm. you guys don't see that you've let the legacy just disappear under your watch, and that nothing's really been done to really reverse the course. A lot is being done to make sure that excellence and anomalies peek through, which, you know, it's sort of in the nature of baseball, like the best players break through, whatever. Everybody knows that. Everybody knows how hard it is to get to the major league. But that not much is being done to make sure that more of those cases can occur. And so it's just bizarre to me that MLB has found themselves in the midst of, you know, the post-2020 world, the post-racial reckoning across the United States, where things are still getting worse for the league demographic-wise. And it doesn't seem like things are working on a wide scale. Which I don't know if it's not apathy, which is the weird part. It's just that they can't do what they claim to want to be doing. And they're tricking people into thinking that the top 1% of talent is representation, where they're exemptions to the trend. Mm-hmm. And those exemptions are being touted as progress, where I don't know if people recognize that per se.
Well, but Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier. So like that's it.
But what about Larry Doby?
Our work's done.
It really does have that vibe. It really does have that vibe. Matt, last question for you. What surprised you most while doing this project? Like, what did you, I know you obviously went into it with a lot of feelings, with a lot of suspicions and everything. And then you, of course, as you laid out, like, tried to come up with real solutions that MLB could take, whether that is from a top-down perspective or from a grassroots perspective, what they could support or what could happen regardless of what MLB does. But what either made you, I guess, more optimistic or less optimistic, or what really caught you off guard the most?
I think I'm most optimistic about the work that's being done at the grassroots level. Simply because, you know, so it's a thesis, but it's more of like a big ass feature story. Like, like it's
relatable.
It's I was like, oh yeah, I'm gonna dismantle all these. And I was like, wait, no, like at some point it's me listening to the stories of people who are doing the work. And so, you know, there's a lot of organizations or a lot of people in organizations that I talk to, but it's just that people like really care about reversing the course and really care about filling the gaps. Like I talked to the guys at Minority Baseball Prospects, and I don't know if you guys are like hip to them, but they're basically like the Black Perfect Game. Mm-hmm. Like that's really what they are. They try to make recruiting possible for every minority baseball prospect that is in America. Any kid posts a video, they retweet it. They're trying to get kids to HBCUs. They're trying to get them in front of college coaches at a wide range. And they're doing it at a great scale right now, but they're obviously not going to be the only ones. And like they're an exemplary option right now, but there are groups that are like them or groups that are smaller than them still doing the work. And that's what's encouraging, is that there's a wide swath of people trying to reverse the course on their own. And that is what's very encouraging to me, that you can see that there's work being done and that black people are lifting as they climb through the sport of baseball and trying to bring people up into the sport to get to that next level and wherever level that they want to reach.
Yeah, definitely. Matt, thank you so much. This has been a pleasure to have you on to talk about this.
A much more legitimate way of conversing about this than we've ever done in the past.
yeah, exactly. For listeners who are interested in this, learning more about these grassroots efforts that you're talking about, the kind of initiatives that are taking place across the country, are there places that they can read about this, find out more about it? Is your thesis like, is it going to drop soon? Like, what's the deal?
I wish. Where's
that PDF, baby?
I'm trying to pitch the thesis out. That's TBD. But, you know, if it doesn't get pitched out.
If any magazine editors are listening, if anybody would like to contact Matt about this, make sure you let them know where they can find you and contact you too.
Yeah. So if anybody ever wants to talk about the thesis, and if they ever want to read it, you can always find me on Twitter. My at name is MKRWRT. It's pretty simple. It's just my initials and some other letters. But I'm always happy to talk about the thesis and like share more of the people who are working on this, where like I wish there was like a database that of organizations that are doing this, but you know, maybe that's the next project. I can always be found on Twitter. That's if you're gonna find me anywhere, it's on Twitter. @YerbaMatt is the name. You know, people refer to me in that in real life.
Sometimes I have a hard time finding your Twitter because I go to search your actual name and then forget that you're on there as Yerba Matt.
Yeah. No,
I never forget, because that's one of the best names on Twitter.
It's so good.
A friend said it to me and was like, I'm gonna use that now. Thank you. And then I think it's been like a year and a half now of just Yerba Matt. I met like people at the Orioles game a couple weeks ago, and like it was like they were like writers, and they were like, "Oh, Yerba," and I was like, "No way!" I was like, "No shots!" I was like, "This can't be real." I'm trying to be a legitimate journalist in the future, and they're just like, "Ah, Yerba," and I'm like, "Ah," just shooting myself in the foot everywhere I go.
There's nothing legitimate about Twitter, so you're fine to put your username whatever you want it to be, man.
It's gonna be tough when it's on my resume as Yerba Matt.
We've talked for 45 minutes and haven't even talked about the Orioles, so we'll have to have you back at some point for your victory lap about the Orioles actually being good despite their GM not wanting them to be good.
I won't take a victory lap until I see Gunnar Henderson on my office. The worst thing is when they're going to bring up Brett Phillips again, and Gunnar Henderson's still going to be in AAA. That'll turn me into a Joker. I'll start rooting for the Nats. I'll jump ship like I should have done in 2005.
Well, a bit of a tough ship to jump to right now.
Want to cop that Luke Voit jersey.
Oh, please.
Matt Ritchie, thank you so much, man.
Thanks again, guys. Appreciate you. Take her tears, put them on ice, 'cause I swear I'd burn the city down to show you the light. We're the therapists pumping through you.
Okay, Alex, thank you to Matt Ritchie, thank you to Artie Moreno, Julio Rodriguez, Bob Castellini. Bill Castellini. Thank you to the five members of our Alex Rodriguez. Thank you to Alex Rodriguez. Thank you to the five members of our Alex Rodriguez VIP club tier, who, with your help, we are going to be able to get Alex Baisley into the Alex Rodriguez A-Rod Corp leadership seminar that we're not sure if it exists. Those five members this week are Shashank, Christina, Nick, Bradley, and Alexander. Anything else to leave the people with?
This is just a quick tangent. It's kind of something that's been bothering me
mm-hmm.
over the last week or so. Okay. So the Little League World Series obviously is in full swing right now. And our honorable former president, George W. Bush, mm-hmm. was on the broadcast was seated next to Rob Manfred.
Sure.
And which, like, yeah, fucking sure. I don't even know what's going on anymore. But I saw a lot of people getting silly jokes off, right? About like, oh, you know, here's a noted war criminal and George Bush, right?
Yep.
Lots of jokes at both of their expense. And it just kind of rubbed me the wrong way because George Bush didn't put in all of that work to be one of the foremost war criminals of our time.
Right.
To get glibly lumped in with a guy like Rob Manfred, who still has a lot of work to do. And look, he might be well on his way, but like, put some respect on George's name. That's all I'm saying.
You sound like Mike Francesa right now. Being like, oh, you're just going to compare Glaber to Derek Jeter?
Right.
For what? He did it for 1 year.
George Bush did not wake up.
That was kind of Boston-y.
Yeah, I know. It kind of was.
How did that happen?
I got to work on it. I don't know. That's all I'm saying. I just like, Manfred's like a prospect.
Oh, okay.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, it's like when the prospect comes up and it's like, he's the next Mickey Mantle. And uh-huh. it's like, okay, well, no, not really. Mickey Mantle is Mickey Mantle.
Do you think if you gave Rob Manfred truth serum, and we really need to end the podcast right now, but uh-huh. do you think if you gave Rob Manfred truth serum, and said, do you want to be president? He would say yes or no?
I don't think he wants to be president. No, I think, especially after this, his tenure as commissioner of baseball, I think he'd be much happier to be the man pulling the strings behind
the curtain. Yeah. Like chief of staff, secretary of state.
Right, exactly.
He would be a terrible secretary of state, actually.
Secretary of labor.
Remember Rex Tillerson?
Yeah, man. That's Chevron God right there.
He's going to be a baseball owner before we're dead, probably.
God, don't put that idea out into the world.
Why? We already have oil magnates owning baseball teams. It's not like it's not like he hasn't thought about it. Maybe he'll buy the Angels.
Would that be better or worse than Artie, you think?
I think it's a wash. Thank you for listening to another ridiculous episode of Tipping Pitches. We'll be back next week.
I'm Alex Rodriguez. Tipping Pitches.
Tipping Pitches.
This is the one that I love the most.
Tipping Pitches.
So we'll see you next week. See ya!